The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program, the last day of October, Halloween as well. And we thank all of you for tuning in. And we have a terrific guest, a good subject, and I think you're going to enjoy this program. So here is a quick run-through of our announcements. For those of you who would like to call us and talk with our guest, who I'll introduce in a minute, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. So do remember that there are no call screeners, so be patient, let the phone ring, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. For those of you listening at work or listening in a way where you can't pick up the phone and call or you don't want to call, you can send in email comments, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can also use the Space Show blog, so open up our website, thespaceshow.com. Go over to the far right side and upcoming shows. And today's program is the first one in upcoming shows. So you simply open that link. It goes to the show page. And then down at the bottom is where you can send comments to us. And I will get a copy of your comments as soon as you hit send. And I can read your comment or question for our guest on air. So lots of ways for you to participate with us, and we do look forward to your participation. Let me give out our toll-free number again, because that is our preferred way, 1-866-687-7223. So the website is thespaceshow.com, and we do have our very detailed website newsletter there. It's in the middle of the page. You can't miss it. And that tells you everything that's planned for this week. So do notice a couple of issues. One is there is no show tomorrow evening. And the next one is that Friday's show may change both as to time and date because of my electric utility company, which says they're going to cut the power for repairs Friday morning, California time. So I won't know if they're really going to do that until pretty much the last minute. So if you notice that there's no show, then you'll get the details of that at our website newsletter, because that's where I will post any changes if we do have to change our Friday show. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or easily download the programs. There is a menu in the upper left-hand corner. So if you go to the support menu, you can find our store where you can buy terrific Space Show t-shirts, coffee mugs, dog clothing, and a lot of other cool stuff. If you're so inclined, it makes great holiday gifts, baby gifts, and gifts for yourself if you want to treat yourself to something. So do check it out. And listen live. Instructions are there. I get a lot of requests for how do you listen to a Space Show program. So you'll see a link in that upper left-hand corner menu, and you'll see Listen Live, and that tells you how to do it. And it gives you direct links to the embedded streaming players. There's three of them, so that you can listen live and also listen on archives as well. There also is a support, the Space Show button in the middle of the page, and an Amazon support page. So we are a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and it is your support that keeps the Space Show going. So we really do appreciate those of you who do support us. Remember, if you are a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you're fortunate enough to be a California taxpayer, you may not think you're fortunate, but if you are that fortunate, you can also get a tax deduction where what is called a California Public Benefit Corporation. So if you have any questions, visit our nonprofit website, which controls the Space Show, 1ONE, GiantLeapFoundation.org, or just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. So also do remember we're trademarked and copyrighted, but we let everybody download our programs or share our URLs, and you're certainly welcome to do that. And there's a couple of rules. So one of them is don't do anything commercial with our programs, and the second one is don't edit them and then put edits up on YouTube or any other website, including your own. And the final one is that we don't permit written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. So please honor those requests. Our full copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of our Space Show websites and One Giant website pages and One Giant Leap Foundation.org website pages. And if you have any questions or a special request, then go ahead and email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. So we do have multiple sponsors, but because one of our sponsors is the guest today, so they are the only sponsor I'm talking about for today. So I am very happy that Orbital ATK is a sponsor, and they are a global leader in aerospace and defense technologies. They are known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. Their banner ad runs across our Space Show homepage, so check it out from time to time, and we're deeply appreciative of Orbital ATK being a sponsor. And our guest today is from Orbital ATK, and so I'm very happy to bring back to the show retired General Jim Armour. And as I said, he is at ATK, and he's been a guest before, and at different positions at Orbital ATK. He's been involved with small satellites, satellite servicing on order on orbit, and all sorts of really innovative, cool things. And his full bio is on the website. So now he works with government affairs with Orbital ATK, and he's over there in Virginia. And we're really fortunate to have Jim back on the Space Show. You can read his full bio on the website. It is there. It's updated. I urge you to do that. And, Jim, welcome back. It's been way too long, and it's good to have you back on the show.
Well, it's nice to talk to you and the audience again, and I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Lots of things have happened over the years. So since you are in government affairs, I think I'll start there. Since you have joined ATK, Orbital ATK, and since commercial space has changed from, you know, the big traditional aerospace companies, there was always commercial aerospace, but, you know, now it's been opened up to entrepreneurs and smaller companies, and, you know, all sorts of different opportunities seem to be emerging with different players. How have you seen the government relations side change?
It's actually gotten a little more steady here in the last few years. There hasn't been as many dynamic changes as in the early part of this current administration, and the programs have settled down. I think on the military side, you've seen the space programs and the DepSecDef and Frank Kendall have even talked about this publicly, you know, how the performance of those major contracts have gotten, you know, have stopped overrunning and settled down and started to deliver the programs. On the NASA and the civil side also, less problems, more stability in both the budget and the delivery of the systems. I'll stop there.
A lot of people have pretty negative ideas or impressions of working with government bureaucrats and representatives. Yeah, I hear you laughing already.
I used to be one, so it's pretty,
well, but you were Air Force, so it's a little bit different when you're active duty military, at least from my perception. You weren't the head of the Air Force pulling your strings. So, and of course, I don't believe the head of the Air Force has ever flown a plane. So maybe I'll just stay away from that. Do you find, and I don't know if you can talk freely or not about it, but are the people in government relations dealing with space issues, are they really knowledgeable? Are they, like space cadets, really interested in space? Or is it just a job and some are really good at it and some are so-so?
Well, the professionals I work with at NASA, NOAA, the National Reconnaissance Office, and the Air Force are all very hardened veterans of space. And we really have had no trouble communicating with them. Now, there's always exceptions, right? But
right.
In general, they've really responded well to innovative approaches, small satellite business. You know, we set up the Operationally Responsive Space Office in sort of my last year when I was in the service in 2007. And that's continued. They're looking at restructuring a lot of big programs into more, you know, operationally responsive space and resilient constellations now. They're experimenting with small, even CubeSat size missions, and that's true for the NASA science missions as well as, you know, the intelligence and national security missions. So, yeah, I've been pretty impressed with the quality of the professionals in all of the civil services.
When you were in the Air Force, was cybersecurity a big deal, or was it just starting?
It was just starting. You know, we sort of recognized that that was going to be a problem, but boy, has it manifested here in the last several years. And it's really become a serious issue that everybody, not just the space community, is having to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you guys deal with that? Are there issues with protecting, you know, satellites and other hardware? Is it something that you're incurring extra cost to do?
Well, it's really affected our whole company. Orbital, you know, ATK before we merged, where I worked, and then Orbital ATK after we merged about 18 months ago. We've had huge attacks. I don't know what else to call them, you know, on our services, and I can't tell you whether they were successful or not, but it was certainly, you know, disconcerting, the variety and the number of attacks. And I know it's no different that the, you know, other companies are experiencing as well in aerospace. So it's not just like the Pentagon or NASA headquarters or the White House. It's industry as well, and it's pretty disconcerting.
Do you know who primarily does it or where it comes from? Or
I do not. You know, the security people sort of have to keep part of that covered to help them pursue, you know, the bad guys, if you will. So they don't talk about it openly. I read the press, and I have some classified beat information from, you know, our contacts in the government, but those are classified and I can't talk about them on this forum. But, you know, it's a wide variety of people that are abusing the system, both state-sponsored and independent.
One of the favorite topics on the space show, because we talk so much about commercial space, is the development and emergence of a small satellite industry, all the way from tiny little CubeSats that you hear about at the SmallSat conference, for example, to more, I guess I use the word professional, smaller satellites that are larger. And there's no shortage of players. I mean, it seems to me that there are very few barriers to industry, and you know, kids in school can get into the industry if they get a launch, and they can make their own small CubeSats. Do you think we're at a point where the small satellite industry is actually a viable commercial industry? And if so, what size satellites are commercial? Like, for example, are CubeSats really viable? I mean, I don't know how many customers they have for their services, but it seems to me like they're primarily still dependent on government as a customer. What's your take on all this?
I think, you know, the CubeSats, the small sats, are just tremendously innovative, and it's really encouraging to see, you know, universities and laboratories and even, like you said, elementary schools. We sponsored an elementary school here in Virginia to launch a small CubeSat, and it was tremendous learning. Now, as far as business case, the business case doesn't quite close on manufacturing of those now. You know, the people who make the kits and, you know, help with that, they've got, you know, they don't make a big profit, and our company really hasn't found a way to get a, you know, a profitable business out of the CubeSats. When you get up to about 80 to 100 kilograms, then yeah, then it starts to become a point where companies like Orbital ATK can think about, you know, a profitable venture. The real key is going to be these large low Earth orbiting communications, wideband internet support constellations of, you know, anywhere from 600 to multiple thousand. If one or more of those companies sort of, you know, closes the business case and starts to launch and operate, that will really fundamentally change, you know, the small satellite business. The reason is they can manufacture a lot of small satellites and drive the cost down for anybody that uses small satellites. And, you know, the technology's been supportive. The price of launch has come way down. And, you know, the business case is just about to close on these things. And I think a lot of us are anticipating what it might look like after that happens.
So when I was writing my dissertation, I had all these sections in it, because it was a business school dissertation,
mm-hmm.
commercial space, and so it sounds like deja vu, because we were talking about Teledesic and Iridium and Globalstar and the one out of the UK, I forget what it is, ITC or something like that, and of course none of them materialized, so I assume there's better technology and probably better manufacturing techniques, maybe even 3D printing is used and some other things to lower your manufacturing cost. But what's fundamentally changing to make it viable now and not 15 years ago?
Well, it's a couple of things. It's the technology of the spacecraft itself, which is you're getting more capacity and capability in a smaller package. The price of launch has reduced, and there's all sorts of ways to get to orbit now, secondary payloads, hosted payloads, ride-sharing, et cetera. But the third leg of that stool is the technology on the ground, you know, the user equipment, the networks and support structure. You know, back in the first cycle in the 90s, like you said, with Teledesic and the others, their handsets were clunky and difficult to use and expensive. And today, that technology is, you know, widespread and very supported. So it's all three, the ground segment, the terminals, the satellite manufacturing, as well as a lower cost launch. None of those are free, but they're lower cost. And so when you add up the costs and the willingness to pay by a large number of customers, the business case just about closes, and it's going to be an exciting decade, I think, ahead to see how many of these big low Earth orbit constellations are going to make it. It's pretty exciting.
So this is primarily to provide a lot of Wi-Fi service. Is that correct?
Well, that's my understanding. They each have their own little niche that they're going after, and you'd have to ask them individually, you know, what they're really after. But, my understanding is, you know, to connect all the people in the world so that they can buy stuff off Amazon.
Well, they can buy stuff off Amazon now.
So. Well, that's the problem.
I guess what they're trying to do is hopefully provide a market, not just to connect people that are not connected, but old style connections such as cable, or DSL or something like that would be old hat and probably far too costly.
Well, mobility is what the world is demanding now. I mean, you can't just sit at your home computer or in your office. You know, it's mobility that these constellations are offering as well, and the whole infrastructure. So we'll see if that works or not.
Now, what is the Orbital ATK interest in this arena? Or
well, we are a satellite manufacturer, and so we're not necessarily a big data house or a big data processing house. We like hardware. We like flying and operating satellites. We think we're good at it, and we have expressed some interest in, you know, these smaller satellite constellations, but that gets into some of our business discussions and that I can't talk about on the air. But yeah, we're a satellite manufacturer that, like a lot of satellite manufacturers, are interested in this new market area.
What is the timeline for seeing successful commercial models in this new industry?
Well, it's definitely within the next 4 to 6 years that you'll start to see them flying and experimenting and seeing if there's really the market that they expect. And then probably another 4 to 6 years after that to flush out the entire constellation. So
10 to 12 years.
Yeah, I would say 8 to 12 years. They are extremely competitive. There's at least three that are really fighting to be first to market. And so they may beat my 8 to 12 year timeline, but because they are aggressively pursuing it.
Now, are you making these satellites to be serviced in orbit for an extended life or something like that, or are they similar with a lifespan to what's up there now, and then you either bring them back or you park them someplace?
Okay, well, the ones we were talking about are low Earth orbit.
So they're going to come back.
Yeah, they are not designed to be serviced, and in fact, they're designed almost to be shorter-lived because they want to continually refresh this constellation with newer and newer technology. They're planning on that, which is another sort of business decision that's very interesting, and we'll see if it works. Now, they do have to worry, and frankly, the ones that we've been talking to are all concerned about the debris problem. It is a serious problem, and they're treating it seriously, and they all have different ways of addressing that issue. And, again, I can't go into detail on that, but I just didn't want the audience to think that, you know, they were taking that lightly. None of the primes that we're talking with are taking the debris problem lightly at all. They're treating it very seriously.
So with planned obsolescence and the constant need to create new technology and get it up in space, that's pretty costly unless you find a magic bullet for severely limiting launch cost and doing some other things, right?
That's right. So they've made a decision to not go for maximum lifetime of these satellites. They're, like I said, they're shorter duration, so they're willing to take some risk on the quality of parts, and, you know, they just count on a certain number of them failing early. It's a completely different mindset, a different strategy, which helps drive the cost of a particular satellite down. So you're mass producing them, you're taking a lower quality and counting on law of large numbers to keep the constellation healthy. It's, like I said, it's a different business model, and we'll see if it works this time. It didn't work in the 90s, but, you know, we've looked at the business case, and it comes really close to closing if you can, you know, meet some of the cost figures for manufacturing and launch.
So Joe is in Houston, Texas, with our first email question of the day, and he says, as a satellite manufacturer, and do you sell the satellites to a user, and then the user has to operate and service the satellites, or do you also have your own operations and you sell only the service of the satellite?
Well, actually, we do both. We build lots of satellite components ourselves and sell the components, so structure, pressure vessels, solar arrays, integrated thermal systems, heat pipes, if you will. And we build our own satellites. We build small to medium communication satellites, scientific satellites. We're building the JPSS weather satellite and the Landsat land imagery satellite. And we have built the small-ish science satellite called Dawn Mission that's out at the Ceres asteroid right now. And each of our customers handles it differently. We do have the capability to fly and operate the satellite if the customer wants us to do that. Often, if it's the government, they want to fly it themselves. They just want us to build it. And often, we are not the prime. We will provide the bus, the structure, but another company will pull it together with the ground segment, pull it together with the launch system, and they will be the prime integrator. We just built the satellite. Maybe some other company will provide the payload, whether it's an optical system or a comm link. I think I answered the question.
Yeah, given the number of entities or entries in the satellite industry and manufacturing parts and this and that, is it considered a mature industry? Is it possible that it could get oversaturated with people or companies making parts, products, satellites, or is the market growing and there's enough room for everybody?
The market is not growing. In fact, in our case, some of our preferred vendors of parts are struggling. In the old days, we used to have two or three or four vendors that we could compete for parts. Now, sometimes we're down to one or two. The problem has been that we lost our export market. Now, that's not just Orbital ATK. That's all U.S. Commercial satellite builders. Because of the, you've heard the famous ITAR, International Trade and Arms Regulations, we pretty much prevented any export of any U.S. commercial satellites for a decade. And as a result, our supply chain, domestic supply chain, just collapsed. So we now build a lot of our own parts, and we struggle to find, you know, preferred vendors in the U.S. That's starting to turn around. I'll give the current administration credit for fixing or updating the export control rules. We're not there yet, but we're starting as a domestic industry to be able to compete internationally much more now. So it's a mixed bag there.
Do you expect that to continue with whatever the next administration looks like, or is that at risk of reverting back?
Oh, my gosh. I have no idea. I mean, you know, you know, we've talked with both of the incoming
candidates.
Candidates.
If you call them that, okay.
Yeah. And we don't really have clear answer on that. We're looking at it purely commercially, to tell you the truth. And both of them seem willing to support U.S. product exports in their own, you know, parties' ways. And that's a good sign. You know, export is good.
So because of the decades-long problem with ITAR and things are changing around now, how does American product technology and innovation stack up to what is coming in from, you know, European or other suppliers? Are they more advanced than American technology and manufacturing, or are we?
Well, they certainly caught up with us over the down decade. But within the last few years, this small satellite, you know, renaissance, basically, and a lot of other things have really, I think, you know, put the U.S. industry back in a pretty positive, aggressively innovative light. And I'm very hopeful if, you know, we can eliminate a little few more of the export rules that U.S. industry and U.S. innovation and creativity at all of our labs and our academic centers will win out the day, if you will. Well, they'll compete very well. They'll compete very well.
You have another question, and this is Harold, who is in San Diego. And, David, I'm at work, so I'm using email today. Jim, on this recent Space Show program, David has been doing programs with some of the guests that stress manufacturing innovation and talk about a fourth industrial revolution, which is already at hand, even if most people have no clue that it is at hand. And they talk about tools and innovation in manufacturing and materials that are really going to change the way most everything is done in the coming years, with a social cost for displaced labor, though they seem to have a plan on dealing with that. Can you address any kind of advanced manufacturing, fourth industrial revolution technology in these industries, from launch industry to satellite industry? Is it something that is controlling, say, what orbital ATK does? Is it just starting to show up? Do you even know what I'm talking about?
I do, and you know, I will tell you that yes, I think we are at the start of almost a fourth generation of manufacturing technology. I call it additive manufacturing. Some people call it 3D printing. It's got a lot of names, but I will tell you that we are investing some significant amount of our own, you know, IRAD, our research and development money, into our own plant and equipment, as finding better manufacturing techniques. And it's got a huge potential for payoff. It also has a huge potential for producing parts and systems that could not be produced at all prior. I mean, extremely difficult to, you know, carve out a piece of metal to the shape. But I'll give you an example. We're also putting a lot of investment into hypersonic technology, and some of the very precise, you know, very high pressure dynamic parts, like inlet valves or things like that on an engine for hypersonic, you almost can't make any other way except by additive manufacturing. And there's other examples of efficiencies that we're finding, not just in additive manufacturing, but in new materials, the carbon nanotube technology, I think, has some surprisingly interesting effects on materials that we're trying to take advantage of in some of our big rocket systems, and some of the new manufacturing techniques for electronics are also pretty impressive, that allow you to pack a lot more capability into a smaller package. So I would agree with Hal that we're on the verge of yet another manufacturing revolution.
This is happening throughout the industry with other companies as well, I tell you.
It is. It is. Pretty much all the ones I'm aware of are investing in a lot of these new technologies and techniques.
Are you noticing it with students coming into the workforce, or younger people coming into the workforce? Are they trained in any of this?
Yes. Academics on some of these new technologies are pretty helpful, and we've been able to hire some excellent young people coming in.
And I'm assuming the military is engaged in this kind of cutting-edge work as well, and the national security defense side of space is also highly engaged in this?
Yes. The national laboratories in particular are very engaged in this, and they actually have pretty good technology transfer programs. Most of them do. Technology transfer, you know, working with industry to, once they discover a new technique or capability, to spin that off and get it into industry. Of course, we have to make our own investments to get it, to extricate it from the lab. As far as the line, Air Force or other, you know, NASA, they're actually trending more towards what I would call fee-for-service or service-level agreements. So they almost don't care what the technology is. I'm being a little bit careful with my statements here. But they're leaning more towards, wow, this is technology that the commercial industry clearly is surpassing us on. So let me just buy the service from a commercial industry provider and not worry about the technology. It's sort of like, you know, the home computer revolution. In a way, you could look at CubeSats as the Apple home computer of the space business, right?
Right.
So many people have gotten involved in it with very innovative things that you can do with it, and it's just exploded. So the U.S. government doesn't really make computers anymore. They buy them from Dell and HP and, you know, out of the catalog. I think that's where the space business is headed.
So this is not your dad's space program anymore, is it?
Well, it's grown and it's gone on to bigger adventures. You know, the really big, really hard stuff where you really can't do it on a for-profit, out-of-business basis, like going to Mars. I mean, you could say SpaceX. Well, SpaceX is doing that, and they don't need NASA. But if you look at it closely, they are leveraging NASA technology and getting grants and other technology transfer support from NASA. It's called the Red Dragon program, and it's very interesting. Our company, Orbital ATK, is not one of the billionaire club. businesses, you know, we're a public company and we have a board of directors and shareholders, and you sort of have to show your business case before the board of directors will let you run open with it.
You're a little bit more grounded in reality, I think.
Well, we'd like to think so. We have good days and bad days like everybody, however.
But, you know, if I were to take a survey of space show listeners, and, you know, I think people know and they hear about additive manufacturing or 3D printing and some of this, but they're really sort of clueless to the degree to which our industrial capacity is changing, and not just in space, but across the board with almost everything that's being made. And the idea of just buying the service rather than worrying about having the technology seems to be really sweeping through lots of segments of things. I mean,
right.
Computers are a great example of that. So you don't even have to buy the software anymore. You know, you can just you can just rent the services of the software and worry about the manufacturer to keep it updated and do everything else. So it's a big change.
Huge.
And so do you think these changes are going to enhance the space industry so we can do more with less? I'm thinking about less money. Are we soon going to be at sort of a breaking point or a crossing point where we're actually able to see that we can do a lot more with a lot less investment because of this?
Oh, yeah, I really think so. You know, we've talked about the communications low Earth orbit constellations, but there's already imagery constellations like Planet and Black Sky and a whole host of others that are imaging and taking weather and doing, you know, GPS radio occultation for high altitude and a whole host of other very interesting missions, all at a commercial pace and at a commercial price. It's amazing. It's pretty innovative.
Janet, this is sort of an interesting twist on a question, is in Seattle. And she said, since you're in government relations, I hope I can explain my question correctly. Is it competitive with other aerospace companies in the government relations field, or is it only competitive to get the government contract, and once you're doing government relations, the competition with other companies is not there? You just have to work out differences with the government.
No, it's pretty competitive from the get-go. Often there's competition just to develop the requirement for the system in the first place. So for example, I almost hate to take an example, but let's say you wanted to build a big rocket, and well, how big a rocket? You know, is it? What kind of specifications do you put on it? And depending on the performance you're looking at, it can favor one contractor versus another with systems they already have. You know, for example, Orbital ATK is really good at solid rocket motors. So if, you know, you're looking for this new rocket to be more solid rocket propulsion oriented, that would put us in a favorable position when the competition finally happens. Okay, so, you know, I don't want to overplay this, but the competition, you know, is pretty much from the get-go. And then once a formal program of record starts, then yeah, you compete heavily to meet the requirements of the solicitation, and you put in your best bid.
Another email question kind of along the same lines, maybe along the same lines, is Ben is in Tucson, and he says, I know you're still doing 5-segment solid rocket booster tests. What mm-hmm. are your plans for using solid rocket boosters? Is it strictly for SLS, or are there going to be other opportunities for such large solid rocket boosters?
We have made an offer to the Air Force for a solid rocket motor EELV class launch system. That is in source selection now, so I can't talk too much about it. But yes, we intend to offer, you know, 4- and 5-segment solid rocket motors with different upper stages to the Air Force for national security launches, you know, basically a follow-on to the Atlas and Deltas. We think we have a really interesting offer. It's very cost-effective, very cost-competitive, but it's an all-solid rocket motor proposal.
Anything for human spaceflight?
Well, they would be qualified for human spaceflight because they basically are taking advantage of the solid rocket strap-ons that we're using for SLS, which were spun off from the solid rocket motors for the shuttle system. And so, yes, they could be relatively straightforwardly human-rated. You know, we're focused at the Air Force and the national security space solicitation at this point, but inherently, they are, you know, rateable for human flight.
Are your solid rocket boosters on schedule, on time, on budget for SLS?
Yes.
And when you do these big tests, which a lot of space show listeners go up to the test in Promontory, and I've been to several of them, but now I know you get a better view of watching them on the Internet than you do in person, although it's more fun in person. Why do you keep doing more and more tests? Are they not ready for prime time yet? Is it just testing to keep the technology going, or do you keep updating or upgrading the technology?
Basically, we're on contract to do a certain number of test firms, and those are, you know, highly instrumented. And we, you know, you're always tweaking and improving each one. So I think the ones so far have primarily been by contract to NASA. This is the ones they've recommended we do X number of them, and we've done that.
So there might be some for the Air Force that you'd be doing down the road?
Yes. As it turns out, because of all of the other things we've done with solid rockets, including the strap-ons for the SLS, But we also build all the ICBMs, you know, like the Trident for the Navy and the Minutemen for the Air Force and targets for Missile Defense Agency, targets and interceptors. So we use that to, you know, it helps us scope down the number of tests that we would need for this new EELV class, Next Generation Launch System. But the Air Force has asked for at least one test flight before they would put a primary mission on any of them, and that's reasonable.
Do you have any idea how many solid rocket flights ATK has done over the years? Is there a total number that comes to
mind? I couldn't even begin to guess. I mean, it goes back to our Pegasus launch system, which is airdropped off of the L-1011, and by the way, we just sold a whole handful more Pegasus to the Stratolaunch company to drop off of their new giant aircraft, you know, in a partnership with Stratolauncher. So, you know, the solid rocket motor business is alive and well. By the way, it's also a you can use 3D printing for solid rocket motors very effectively. You can help shape both the chemistry and the shape of the propellant in that way, and it saves money, and it's very efficient and very reproducible. It's like digital manufacturing.
Well, you're not mixing the propellant with it making the propellant with it. You're changing the chemical nature of it?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, we do mix it before you know, you put it into either the molds or the printer. Then that affects the material as well.
Amazing. I wonder where all of this will be in 10 years.
I don't know, but it'll probably be less expensive. Prices are going down.
And there'll probably be different technologies. I'm assuming that all of this will lead to more technologies. We're a little beyond the halfway point. So, listeners, I'm going to take us to a pause for a couple of minutes. And for those of you that can access our phone line, it is 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we'll be back in 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Monday, October 31st, Halloween Space Show program. Our guest today, Jim Armour, Orbital ATK. We do have an email question that came in during the break that I want to ask you up front. from Michael Listener, one of our resident space attorneys, and he says, your guest makes an interesting point about solids. Not only does a solid rocket business provide a necessary component for satellite launches, it also provides vital infrastructure for national security purposes, such as ICBMs, SLBMs, etc. So that's more or less a comment for you, but do you want to comment on anything he said?
No, I totally agree with him. That's it's a key industrial base issue for the United States. And we have, a number of audits, if you will, by the Department of Defense that come in and make sure that this part of the industry base, solid rocket motors and solid rocket chemicals, getting the chemicals, ammonium perchlorate is one of the principal chemicals used, that we have enough strategically to for our forces and for our needs. So yeah, the Department of Defense keeps their eye on that, and we talk with them regularly about solid rockets as a key industry.
So as an aside, you said something that reminds me of something. So yesterday, after my Sunday space show, I went to the local Barnes & Noble bookstore because Leonard David, who I'm sure you know.
I know Leonard, yes.
And Pascal Lee, who you may know, mm-hmm. At NASA Ames and at SETI, were there talking about Leonard's new Mars book in this National Geographic mini TV series, six-part series starting on November 14th called Mars or something like that. And you can see the trailer, and actually you can see the first chapter of this six-part series on the National Geographic website. And they'll probably have them all up there. But Leonard got a question, which kind of blew me away, because I thought the audience was basically a general interest audience, not a space cadet type of audience. A lot of families were there with little kids going, wow, ooh, and on. And it's kind of a basic talk. And this woman stands up and wants to ask Pascal and Leonard about the saturation of perchlorates in the Martian soil, and are there perchlorate-rich areas or absent mm-hmm. areas? And she works for the California Environmental Organization, for the state organization, in an Oakland office on groundwater contamination, and perchlorates are a big issue, and she knows about this from rockets, but it's not a big issue in her particular district. Mm-hmm. And I was actually kind of blown away with that. So I asked her after the Leonard David talk was over with if she could find someone who was really an authority on perchlorates from rockets and groundwater contamination, soil contamination, that would be willing to talk about it on the space show without a lot of drama queen crap, because I'm not interested in that. Just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. So she didn't know anybody, but she took my card, and maybe or maybe not that'll materialize. But so are you, not you personally, but is like ATK sensitive to contamination from using ammonia perchlorate? Is that an issue at all?
It's a hazardous material, and we have to follow the rules very carefully. That's one reason we do the test firings and the pouring of the materials out in the middle of nowhere. We're sensitive to our environmental management rules, and we obey them. And we have lots of inspections. So, yeah, it's a difficult material, and you have to handle it properly. Now, the perchlorate in the Martian soil is, that's formed naturally over the history of Mars, and it's sort of a different issue.
No, that was just her question. I was asking her about groundwater contamination around rocket launch sites in America,
mm-hmm.
and I asked her specifically about Vandenberg, and she didn't mm-hmm. know anything about it. So that's not my region. I don't have any responsibility there.
Yeah.
That's the typical bureaucrat. But So you are, is there things that you do to try to limit ground contamination, or is it hopeless?
You'd have to ask someone a little more expert than I on that, and we can certainly get somebody for the show that could talk solid rocket chemicals and where we get them and how we manufacture them and what the hazards are for making it and burning them during a launch.
I'd be really interested if you could do that. I mean, I
sure.
thought it was an interesting topic, and I was kind of blown away when she... I didn't expect that kind of question coming out of that audience at Barnes & Noble. Satellite servicing. So we've talked about this before, and you talked about it during the break, and I also mentioned that Dennis Wingo, who's probably been on the space show 20 times or so, and is a good friend of mine, has been talking about this since the first day I met him when I was writing my doctoral dissertation. And of course, you do some things with Dennis. So where are we at? Is this about to close a business case?
We have closed the business case.
Okay.
At the Space Symposium in April, we announced our first contract. We signed a life extension contract with Intelsat, the company that has a fleet of about 50 communication satellites. And we have also signed a contract for a launch in December of 2018, and our customer, Intelsat, expects us to be on station to dock with one of their satellites in May of 2019 so that we can extend its life.
So this is all robotic. There's no people involved.
It is. Right? It's all robotic, and it actually docks with the Intelsat satellite automatically. Obviously, there's people ground control in the loop, and you know it's going to what we call waypoints. It goes basically a little backpack that docks to the apogee kick motor and launch ring of any standard communication satellite.
And what can it do? What can it repair?
It doesn't repair anything. It is a backpack. It takes over pointing and station keeping for the satellite. The satellite would turn off its own motors, and we would take over guidance, navigation, and control. The best description of it I heard was in the Economist magazine in August, where they called it a mobility scooter for elderly satellites. And so this little scooter docks to the satellite, that's basically a satellite that is still producing revenue. It still works, but it's out of fuel. And this becomes sort of a backpack that takes over accurate pointing and accurate station keeping. We've had a lot of conversations with many satellite operators. Not all of them want just simple life extension, but they would like us to move their satellite to a new market area, for example, without burning their own fuel, or some of the communication satellites will drift. They go inclined over time. They drift out of their, you know, the perfectly geostationary, and they go, you know, in inclined orbit. They want us to dock with it and bring it back down to its, you know, correct orbit. Or when it's old and they're finished with it, they want us to dock with it, move it to its disposal orbit, you know, 300 or 400 kilometers higher, and then we would undock and go to our next customer. So it's just a little utility backpack that can attach to any satellite in geostationary that has an apogee motor and a launch ring.
Do you have any competition doing this, or is a competition soon to start, or what?
Well, we don't have any that we know of right now, but we know that there's probably three or four that are getting underway with their own version of satellite servicing. Some of them are more complicated. They want to go right to refueling. That's in our future plans, but not our first vehicle. We're taking a crawl, walk, run approach. We want to do simple docked life extension first. And then as we get better at it, then we'll start to add a little more complicated robotics, maybe some minor repair, or just add a battery or actual refueling. But, again, our first vehicles are going to just be simple docked life extension.
About what is the size of this backpack?
It's about 2,000 kilograms. It's actually 2,700 kilograms when you load it with fuel. It's electric propulsion, so it's slow and steady. I'll stop there. Did you have another question?
What do you launch it on? Is it rocket agnostic or is it on?
It is rocket agnostic. Our first launch, we are actually going to dual launch with a Comsat, a Eutelsat Comsat, on a Proton launch vehicle out of Ukraine. So there'll be two of us. There'll be the mission extension vehicle. We call it the MEV, and a small Comsat on one launch vehicle going to geostationary.
So it's not a secondary.
No, it's you know, like I said, it's 2,700 kilograms. So it's a small Comsat.
Okay, so Lori sent in a note from St. Louis and says, David, I'm also at work. But my question is, I've always heard when this subject comes up that satellite companies were reluctant to invest money into extending the life of their satellite or repairing them because they're usually old and worn out and ready for replacement. So why does a company want to extend an old, probably less than modern technological bird when they could put a new one up?
The answer is they want to manage their resources, meaning their constellation, in an efficient way. Not all of their customers on the ground that are using the comm services are you know, the first world customers like Europe and North America. There's a lot that don't need a fully robust satellite. You know, a nice used satellite that has limited capability will work fine. In fact, we're starting to see a market for what I'll call used satellites, where a customer, let's say over, I don't know, Africa, wants to buy a used satellite off of Intelsat and put it over their area and use it for, you know, just a year or two or however long it lasts, and then they'll go buy another used satellite. For the big constellation operators like Intelsat, SES Americom, Eutelsat, Telsat, et cetera, they want to address their customers' needs efficiently. You don't need a brand new satellite to cover every single person in their clientele. So it's a resource management issue that allows them to do a much more cost-effective way of reaching all their customers.
So sort of like a certified pre-owned BMW or something.
Well, yeah. You know, you don't always need a brand new car. Now, sometimes you do, you know, to get the high performance stuff. Yeah. And there's some really tremendously new fancy Comsats, you know, to replace some of the key positions. Viasat's new, satellites are just awesome. but at some point, they're going to run out of fuel and they may need to, you know, maybe their replacement satellite, blew up on the ground, you know.
Uh-huh.
They say, oh, no, we need to extend the life of this one until we can get a replacement satellite up there.
So how many years of life extension are you expecting with your backpack?
The MEV has a design life of over 15 years.
Wow.
And we have probably over almost twice that in fuel. So we can dock and undock multiple times. So we figure on average, customers are going to be asking for 3 to 5 years of life extension. Then we'll probably go off and do some orbit adjustments, you know, bringing down inclination, moving an old satellite to a new market area so they can test that market area to see if it's going to be productive, and maybe they should buy a new satellite for that new market. Or doing an inspection of a broken satellite, one that's seems not to be operate, we can, you know, fly around it and inspect it and see if that's helpful information, and then go back and do another life extension for another 3 to 5 years. So it's sort of a utility backpack, and we've found the different customers have found very creative ways to think about using it. I'll tell you, the insurance companies also like it. They're selling insurance just to have it on standby in case one of your new satellites goes awry and doesn't operate correctly. If you could pay a small fee, and then we have an MEV, you know, in the queue in case you had an emergency.
So this is ready to be launched, not on standby in on orbit.
Well, we would, just like airlines, when the airliner is sitting on the ground, it's not making revenue, so they fly it pretty much continuously if they can. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to use our MEV, sign up customers for the 15 to 25-year life of the MEV, and always have something to do, right? So if there was a insurance event, we would probably rejuggle our constellation of MEVs to address that that new need, right?
So they would be flying in some sort of constellation ready for use.
Well, they would be flying in use, right?
In use, so, okay.
Right. So what we've talked, for example, with one company is if they had were using four MEVs to extend life on four of their fleet constellation, they launched a new one and it didn't go quite right, they would decide, hey, disconnect from this one for a while, go do the business with the broken one, and then when you're finished after a month or so, come back and continue the life extension of that one satellite. It's a constellation management tool, and they can use it for whatever they want, you know, to balance their needs.
Then your MEV can match orbits, can change orbits, can be really maneuverable?
Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's a pretty flexible piece of equipment.
So you have the first contract signed, but you don't have the constellation up there yet, right?
We do not. But we have already ordered long lead parts for additional vehicles, and we are in healthy discussion with a number of clients and both government and commercial.
excuse me. Andy is in Chicago, and he also sent in an email. Looks like this is going to be an email show day. And he says, I'm also at work, David. Jim, what is Orbital ATK's philosophy or plans or ideas about rocket reusability, or is it not yet part of what you're thinking about for the future?
It is not yet part of what we're looking at. We just haven't found a good strategy in our sweet spot of solid rocket motors that plays well in the reusable domain. Now, some of the industry partners we're working with, solid rockets can be part of a reusable system. But that's the extent of what we're looking at this point. That could change over time, but for right now, that's where we are.
Okay. And do you see yourself down the road engaging in human spaceflight with rockets that you're building?
Well, yes. And in fact, we've already done that. Like I mentioned, we build the solid rocket motors for the space shuttle.
Yeah, I'm thinking more than just the solid rocket motors, the actual rocket for, like SLS is contracted with other participants and you're making X components for it. But are you thinking that you might someday make your own rocket for human spaceflight?
Well, the only approach would be if they allowed humans to launch on the EELV class that we've offered to the Air Force. We really haven't looked at like a SpaceX or a Blue Origin or a Virgin Galactic. We haven't really looked in that direction yet, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah, sort of what I'm asking. So it's out there, but inanimate, I guess.
Well, we just haven't figured out a good business case for it, like we did in satellite servicing. We think we found a really good niche, and we're going into it significantly.
this is another one. I would have never thought of this one. So Paul is in upstate New York, and he said, well, you mentioned that you're launching on a Proton. Would you launch on the new Angora Russian rocket at their new spaceport when that becomes available? Or what do you require out of a rocket before you would want to use it for a commercial activity?
Well, it's a complicated answer, but basically it needs to be reliable and insurable. Other than that, we're sort of agnostic. You know, right now we're precluded from launching on Chinese or Indian launch vehicles, and those are good vehicles, but, you know, we have laws against it.
Laws against the Indian vehicles?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure it's a law or a regulation, export regulation, but we can't do that.
I understand.
We wish we had more U.S. options. We can fly on Ariane. You know, we could do an Atlas, but those are kind of expensive compared with the going global rate for launching of a CompSat, and which basically the MEV is a, you know, modified CompSat.
How do you define reliable? So does it have to, so for a new rocket, does it have to have 50 successful flights or 20 successful flights, or is it not measured that way?
Yeah, I don't know really. It depends. You know, as the old saying goes, but you know, it has to be insurable. We're not going to launch on something that we can't get insurance for. That's sort of the acid test, and you know, legal and insurable and reliable. And reliable, we've got rocket scientists that work for Orbital ATK, and they can make pretty good judgments on these things. I'm not the guy.
Is the Liberty Rocket Project dead, or is that sitting there waiting for a new breath of life?
It's on the shelf right now. We're really focused on the next generation launcher for the EELV class. That's where we got our A team, if you will.
So where do you you mentioned that others have more complicated ideas for satellite servicing. So do you think this is going to be a routine industry in say, 10 years? And what kind of bells and whistles will be there for this industry? Because you're talking about yours is pretty basic just to get it jump-started.
Yeah. No, we have a roadmap that we're looking at so that we're going to try and launch two more about every 18 to 24 months. We want to have a constellation of 5 to 10 of these, and each one we launch, we want to add more and more capability to. So our long-term plan is to add refueling, because if you think about it, being attached for years to another satellite is not all that efficient. Now we've gotten the price down to where it's cost, where it is. The business case closes. Customers, the CompSat businesses, will pay the fee to extend the life of those satellites. But refueling, you could do a lot faster. Turns out that's really hard, and that they sort of have to design their satellite to be refueled. So that's why it's going to take a while. Also, small minor repairs, maybe adding a battery or putting on a new solar array or fixing a broken one. So small robotics with a low number of tools would be one of the things that we look for early in our roadmap. And to that end, we have very active Space Act agreements and other arrangements with NASA, almost all the NASA centers, for technology transfer of what they're doing on a lot of their missions. For example, the RESTORE-L mission, which is going to refuel a Landsat in low Earth orbit, is a pretty interesting mission to us, and it's developing a lot of technology that that we would love to for them to transfer to industry, including us.
But you're not using a depot, which we talk about on the space station. This is the refueling satellite's going to go connect directly to your satellite to refuel it.
Well, funny you should mention that, because we do have, you know, long-term aspirations for a depot. We can't quite get the business case to close in our own minds yet, except for government users who are willing to pay more, by launching fuel from the Earth to fill the depot. We think we're going to have to look for, you know, sort of in situ opportunities, probably lunar or whatever, to, you know, put that depot in operation, and that is not going to happen in the near term. These are my own thoughts. Let me reiterate your opening comment on the show, not necessarily my company's.
So listeners also talk about the grand, you know, vision or whatever you want to call it, that we're going to make fuel on the moon and mm-hmm. then, you know, use depots from the moon, because that'll be a
mine asteroids.
Yeah, the whole bit.
Are
you thinking of getting fuel from the moon down the road? Does that enter into your serious discussions?
It's in our long-term vision, and we do talk with a lot of those new companies and actually big companies, other big companies, way bigger than us, about these possibilities. And but again, the business cases haven't closed yet. We have these and many other ideas in the long view. In fact, you know, we're so convinced that this is a prospering niche that we actually started a separate company. It's called Space Logistics, LLC. It's right now, it's a wholly owned subsidiary of Orbital ATK, but it's actually the Space Logistics, LLC that is offering the mission extension vehicle as sort of our, you know, crawl, walk, run. This is our crawl, doing simple life extension. But, you know, we think in the long run, Space Logistics being able, you know, to carry stuff, fix stuff, refuel stuff in orbit, in cislunar, or out at the Lagrange points, is a long-term business area that we want to be involved in.
When you talk about closing a business case, so let me see how to word this question and efficiently, since we're coming up toward the end of the show. If I cite an example on the space show of business analysis and doing a business case, and, mm-hmm. and I'm using a typical, maybe somewhat risky terrestrial business,
mm-hmm.
okay, and it's pretty straightforward on what you need to make a profit at some point to close the business case, are you adding any different or unique variables or fixed items because this is a project regarding space, or is it pretty much the same analysis one would learn in closing a business case in business school?
It's pretty much the same as a classic business school case study. The thing that should be emphasized is the capital expenditure that is necessary to start up most space businesses is huge.
Right.
So you've got to get, you know, not just a good management team, not just competent technology, not just, you know, a good handful of first customers that are willing to pay, but the financing, you know, has got to buy almost all the infrastructure at the beginning. So, you know, we've been a space company for decades now. We've figured out how to raise enough capital to get that, you know, buy down that infrastructure cost or get the financing for the infrastructure cost at the beginning, and then, you know, make a profit over the, you know, get a revenue stream started and then make a profit after a certain number of years to satisfy our stockholders and our board of directors. And we think we've I think we got another winner here in satellite servicing for the long haul.
Does your satellite servicing company have a website, Space Logistics?
No, not yet.
Okay. So because of that upfront capital acquisition cost, that puts a stress on your management and other components.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really looking for a different kind of team member or person to be involved that understands that kind of environment. So it's a little different from a terrestrial business that way.
Sure. Yeah. You have to have somebody that understands the business, right? The real needs of the customers, the way the technology works, the risks, just understands the risk of this business. It's pretty unique, as you must admit.
Do you factor in a political risk, that is, possible changing regulations or regulatory environment?
We haven't had to. We were worried about that. I mean, I started working on this, back in 2009, and the guys I've been working with, worked it for a decade prior to that. And, yes, the regulations and licensing were a worry. But we spent a lot of time over the last 7 years working with all the government agencies and being extremely transparent and cooperative in working all of the worries of the government, and we think we're in really good shape to do that. We worked with the FAA Commercial Space Transportation Office to do a payload review, a payload safety review. Now that's just for launching, but they were very positive and open in looking at how we plan to do the mission as well. We talked with the FCC about orbit management, because we won't just stay in one place, and when we do, we're sharing it with another vehicle. They're good with that. They've got arrangements for that, as well as sharing spectrum with our client. The most interesting one that your listeners might get a kick out of is, because we have cameras for rendezvous proximity operations as we're approaching our customer from the aft end of their commercial compsat, we see the Earth in the background, and therefore we have to file a remote sensing license. I know that sounds kind of silly.
So if you see the Earth, that requires a remote sensing license?
It does, yes. And so we filed that. Again, this has been several years now. And I will tell you, all of the government agencies have just been over backwards trying to help us, because they would really like to see a U.S. company do this first and set good precedent. They, NOAA, to their credit, they formed an interagency group, and we talked with all of the agencies and departments in the government and got all the heads nodding. There was on how we manage the data, what our mission operations sequence would be, when we were taking imagery and when we weren't, and on and on. So they actually gave us a license for remote sensing and operations for our first 10 vehicles. We think we're in pretty good shape. The last little worry bead we have is the Outer Space Treaty. Article 6 requires that the government authorize and continuously supervise their missions, right?
Yeah, what you do, uh-huh.
Right. And we think both the FCC has agreed to do that, and the State Department has, at this point, agreed that the FCC can qualify for that. So we think we've got all the bells and whistles and all the T's crossed and I's dotted for proceeding with this. Now, we don't launch until December of 2018, our first vehicle, and our operations are in May of 2019.
Do you guys have a department like for future dream visions or something like that? How do you who is responsible for, or is there a department responsible for fantastic visions?
No, that's one reason I really have enjoyed working for ATK and now Orbital ATK. I feel like every division and department has been encouraged to do innovative things, you know, from the launch businesses to the manufacturing guys looking for, you know, neat new ways to manufacture things, to the materials people looking for new material that could be used in hypersonic environments, to the small satellite guys, and to starting a whole new market area of satellite servicing. You know, we felt welcome to explore that in this company, and I think it paid off, and I've really enjoyed working.
We're pretty much at the end of our 90 minutes. What have I failed to ask you that you wanted to talk about, or that I should have asked you, or that I've forgotten to ask you? What have we omitted, or what should we have said or talked about?
I think we've got it pretty well covered. The one last thing I'll mention on the mission extension vehicle is it has a huge amount of hosted payload capacity. It basically is a geostationary bus that only has a docking system on one end. The whole rest of the vehicle you can use for whatever you want. And we've had other clients that say, hey, could you fly this thing? I want to fly and test it in geo for a couple of years, and then it's done, and you can either eject it or hold on to it or whatever you want to do with it and go do your regular business. So we basically have a satellite bus for lease to anybody who wants to use it. It doesn't just have to be for life extension.
So that's kind of a secondary test platform instead of just the ISS having one.
Yeah, we've talked to people who want to use our bus to deploy CubeSats in geostationary. And a whole host of other options. So, you know, as far as business case, it's not just the primary mission. We've discovered, you know, we've tapped into a whole new hosted payload rideshare to geo mission. And one of the other future things we're looking at is what I'll call high-power propulsion, solar electric propulsion, so we could turn this into a tug that can move things from geotransfer orbits to geo orbit. The way it is today, it's good for station keeping and small orbital adjustments like to the disposal orbit, but it really can't do heavy lifting, and we want to turn it into a heavy lifter as well.
So,
and I'll stop there.
I've heard from two companies doing Kickstarter that want to make a Model M drive and kick it out off of the space station or something to test it. So essentially they could do that with you.
Well, if they want to do it in geostationary or higher orbit, we would be a better platform. You know, the ISS is awesome, but it's in low Earth orbit. So
they get up to geo to test that.
Yeah, if they want to ride to geo, we might be an option for them.
Interesting. Jim, I want to thank you for giving us a really good glimpse behind the green door, so to speak. The green door being green for dollars. And really fascinating, and a lot of great information and things that we didn't know were going on. So we appreciate it very much. And look forward to talking to you again down the road.
All right.
Thank you, David.
Thank you
again. Listeners, remember Hotel Mars Wednesday on Tabby's Star, with the Berkeley SETI Group, and then possibly Friday on Debris, and then back on Sunday. So everybody have a great week, a good Halloween, and thank you for listening to Jim Armour, myself, and The Space Show. Goodbye, everyone.